Q1.
Disney's freedom has been stripped away from her. Paige's life has been taken away from us. These women won't be able to tell their stories. And it is for them and girls like us that I decided to step forward and finally tell my story and own my truth. And so I made the choice to use my voice, to speak up, to live visibly. Because being silent would be a disservice, not only to me, but to the women who came before me and the brothers and sisters who I fight alongside today and the ones whose voices have been silenced by intolerance and hate. I had to be honest with myself about the totality of my experiences. And the funny thing about honesty is that it's not only a gift you give to other people, it's one you give to yourself.
Yeah, and of course, that is the ever amazing Janet Mock. And again, we will have her on, I guess, towards the bottom of the hour. So look forward to that. While I restore all the windows that I had up all ready to go for the show, which I of all these different windows, I have my browser window, I have my question lists, I have all this stuff that I put up there. And, of course, needless to say, I lost it all while I was busy kicking the stunk things out of the wall and crap. But I wanted to start off tonight with something that you might not have expected. Something you might not have expected. I want to talk about the Human Rights Campaign. But I'm not going to bash them. Not this time. Because I'll tell you something. If you've been paying attention to what's been going on in Delaware, in North Carolina, basically around workplace rights, around ENDA, HRC has really been stepping up, okay? Now, you know me. I am the first one to criticize these guys when they're doing the wrong thing, and that's not going to change. They fuck up again, I'm right there, okay? I will call them out when they deserve to be called out. But you know what? Here's the thing, and I say this all the time. When they do the right thing, you got to call that out too. And they are doing the right thing in this case. They have put boots on the ground. They have put money into this. And you know, here's another interesting thing. And I want to find this article that I had, which, of course, I had ready to go. And, of course, now I, have to dig it out. But I'll tell you. Lisa Murkowski, Senator Lisa Murkowski, who is a Republican from Alaska, she said that one of the reasons why she voted in favor of ENDA, one of the reasons she voted in favor of the bill was because she got over 1,000 postcards from her constituents in support. And that postcard event, that postcard drive, was facilitated and run, I guess, by the Human Rights Campaign. And you know something? I'll tell you. Here's the thing, okay? This is what people are always so angry about with the Human Rights Campaign when they don't do the right thing. It's like you want to say, you see what happens when you take those resources, when you take that power, that influence that HRC can muster, that the money, the boots on the ground, the effort, the skills that they have, that they bring to the table, and you use them to support an issue like this, guess what? You bring senators around. You got a Murkowski. I mean, seriously, this is why we call you guys out when you do the wrong thing, because we say, God, if they just would do the right thing, it could mean so much. It could make such a difference. And this is the proof right here. When these guys put their mind to it, they can kick ass. Seriously. Okay? I mean, that's why I am always so passionate. When they screw it up, when they do something like that flag thing, the flag protest, you remember that, you say, come on. Okay, in 2009, with the whole thing, this is a little trivia. Well, I don't know about trivia, but when I was at Netroots Nation, they had Nancy Pelosi. You may have heard about this. She actually got heckled by the crowd. I was in there. I was in the room when this happened. Okay, Nancy Pelosi got heckled by the crowd at Netroots Nation over Edward Snowden, over the guy who leaked all the, the PRISM and all that stuff. And that's, she got heckled about it, but she went, they asked her, they hit her with a question about ENDA. And basically what she said was, well, the community told us that we were not enthusiastic about ENDA. We'd rather get don't ask, don't tell done. Which, and like people are looking at each other at these tables watching this going on. It's like bullshit. Bullshit. What we mean is HRC and the big money donors weren't enthusiastic about it, so we decided to go for the money. Is that what it really was about? Okay, you know, when you do stuff like that, when you do stuff that hurts the effort, then you know what? You're going to get called out for that. But when you do the right thing, when you get your shit together, when you say, you know what? We have the power. We have the influence. We have the numbers. We've been able to do make a difference here. And you do it. You know what? Then you deserve to be called out for that. You deserve to be commended. You deserve to be complimented. Okay? And I'll tell you, I'm saying it right here on the show. HRC is stepping up, and kudos to them for doing it. Now, if we can just get you to hire some of us, that would be really good, because we can still count the number of HRC employees that have worked for this organization on the fingers of one hand. So that's step number two, HRC. Now we know you can do this stuff. Number one, you got to keep it up. Let's see. Bring this home. Okay? This does not end after Harry Reid calls for a Senate vote. This is an ongoing situation, every bit as much as marriage, every bit as much as don't ask, don't tell, still is, because, you know, you may have gotten those gays and lesbians squared away, or at least squared away in terms of legislation. There's still a lot more in terms of implementation that needs to happen there, but, you know, just keep it up. You know, you've proved that you can do it. You've shown that you got the chops, that you can, that you've got the willingness, that you're willing to buckle down, that you're willing to look past the marriage issue. Because let's be honest here. Right now, as it stands right now, marriage has pretty much come to a head. I mean, it's gone. The Supreme Court has ruled federally. Now, of course, there's a lot of things to be done at the state level in marriage, of course, New Jersey and blah, blah. But as far as federally, that's done. It's done because there ain't nothing happening in Congress. Okay, yeah, sure, there's a few idiot Republicans who are trying to pass a federal marriage amendment, which is going nowhere. They couldn't even get it passed when George Bush was in office. They couldn't even get a decent amount of people supporting it when George Bush was in office. So forget that. That's just right-wing nonsense that nobody should bother to pay attention about. But here's the thing. Now that that is done at the federal level, okay, yeah, there are going to be some state fights coming up, but you know what? People need jobs. People need job security. People need to know that they're not going to be fired for being gay, that they're not going to be fired for being trans. And guess what? We have finally have, at least now, we finally have politicians who are listening. Which we didn't have in 2009. But that's the reality. You gotta, you know, I mean, let's be honest here. If we're gonna be brutally honest about what the situation is, okay, there is not a big possibility. There's not a strong likelihood, regardless of what Senator Merkley says, regardless of what all these other guys say, which they have to say, because what else are they going to say? But I guess, you know, there's not a strong chance that this is going to make it through the House. There's a very good chance, I believe. There's a at least fairly reasonable, decent, very good chance that we will see a successful vote in the Senate. But, come on, I mean, we're not even, they can't even get fucking immigration reform through the House. You know, I mean, there's still, it's still wackadoodle city over there. And I just don't see how that happens in this particular session of Congress. I just don't see it. I wish I felt differently. I mean, is it possible? Sure it is. I mean, nobody thought that the Violence Against Women Act was going to make it through. But you know what? This is gay. This is trans. I don't think you can only pull that stunt once or twice, okay? Because now Boehner is crawling up inside the Hastert rule. You know, well, we're only going to get it done, boo-hoo, if the Republicans, the majority of Republicans vote for it. You know, I mean, you know, we're hearing that nonsense again, which, of course, is bullshit, because if you're waiting for all Republicans, for a majority of Republicans, there's not anything that the majority of Republicans are going to vote for in the House except for abortion bans and Obamacare repeal. I mean, seriously, let's be honest, okay? You know what? The truth is it's possible, not guaranteed, but it's possible that if Boehner brought the thing up for a vote, if he brought it up for a vote, it's at least possible that with full Democratic support, or at least nearly full Democratic support, and some Republicans, they could pass. It is not out of the realm of possibility. Okay, maybe it's a long shot, but it's not impossible. But it's got to get to a vote first. Okay, personally, I think this thing where they have the what do they call it? There's a procedure. I can't think of the name of it right now. There's a procedure in the House where they can call for a vote without the speaker. They have to get 218 votes, and in order to do that, not so sure that they're going to be able to pull that off. But I do think that it is possible that if it got to a vote, it could theoretically pass. Okay, just like we saw, okay, the Violence Against Women Act. I think, you know, it's interesting because Chris Geidner actually wrote a really good article. One of the things he wrote about over at BuzzFeed was that even the Republicans who were voting against ENDA in the HELP committee, in Tom Harkin's committee, which just passed it out for to the full Senate, even the Republicans that were against it, they either didn't show up and voted by proxy, which means they weren't physically there, but they cast their votes, or the one that was there, Lamar Alexander, voted against it but didn't say anything. Nobody wants to come out and say, that's right, I'm anti-gay, I'm anti-trans, I want to stop those people. Those days are over. They know it's bad politics. You may feel that way, you may want to vote that way, but you don't want to go on camera and say it. Because you know what? They're starting to discover there's just too many voters on their own side who are saying, you know what? This is bullshit. I don't have a problem with these people. Just like the same way at the federal level, there's a problem with this anti-woman rhetoric, with this abortion rhetoric nonsense. They want to vote anti-abortion. They want to vote new restrictions on abortion, but they don't want to come out and talk about it. They don't want to advertise it because they know it's bad politics. Because all it does is it casts them as the evil white guys who hate women, or the evil white guys who hate gays, or the evil white guys who hate blacks or Hispanics or whoever. That's the way it's playing. And you know what? Don't forget, yes, the Republicans took back the House in 2010. Well, you know, it could go the other way too. And I think they're conscious of that. It's not that huge of a difference at this point. And so I think they're conscious of that. And I think what it is they don't want to change their opinions, or at least not a lot, but they also don't want to advertise it. Because you know what? Too many people have a gay or trans brother, sister, son, friend, nephew, student, cousin, whatever. Too many people know who we are. Too many people have made that connection. Too many people have come to understand, you know what? This person is living their life, and it doesn't affect me one way or another. These are two wonderful people over here. They just got married. They're both guys. My life hasn't changed. I don't see God throwing lightning bolts down to strike us dead. Life has pretty much gone on, you know, California, they had gay marriage, then they didn't, now they do. Doesn't seem to make much of a difference in the average straight person's life, does it? No, doesn't really. And oh my goodness, it seems like the time just flies. All right, we have got to get Janet Mock on the line. We have got a quick musical interlude for you, the ever-amazing Jane County and Transgender Nation. And we'll catch you in a few days.
We're talking about some real sick stuff here. Man on man, hairy baby, BDSM, bottoms acting like tops, tops acting like bottoms. It's just the whole world gone topsy-turvy.
Q1.
Thanks for tuning in, and I am so excited because we have finally got on the show somebody who I've wanted to interview for a long time now. And hey, Janet, how are you? Are you on?
Yes, I am. So great to hear from you and share this space with you, Becky.
Oh, thank you so much for coming on. I'm so excited. I'm saying at the top of the show that you know, I've thought that you become kind of a celebrity, a mainstream media trans celebrity, so quickly. I have to say, it seems like you almost popped out of nowhere. It's like all of a sudden you were there, and it was like, whoa. And so I guess the first question I want to ask you is, where did you come from? I know you were a writer for People magazine for their website. Was there a point? I mean, how did you wind up on MSNBC and becoming a media figure, I guess is the best term for it?
I think I had a bizarre advantage, right? Because I worked within mainstream media. So I think that I had just a natural kind of network of people that I had already known pre-coming out and pre-sharing my story in Marie Claire in 2011. So it was kind of like when I kind of launched forward with just sharing a personal story, I think it made it easier being that I was someone very connected to social media, someone very connected to mainstream editors and producers on television shows that I had worked with, that it made it kind of like the natural transition to go into speaking about, I think, these issues on a national level, in a sense, through media. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the media spokesperson-y role was just kind of natural, if that makes sense, because of what I did for a living, except that I wrote about celebrities before and lifestyle issues than about political issues and organizing and all of that stuff.
I hear you. I, because it was so interesting, because up until you kind of rose to prominence, I mean, the only trans celebrity type person you could really argue was Chaz Bono. And it's almost like he's kind of like, yeah, he's an author, but it's almost like reflected celebrity because his mother and father were famous and, you know, everybody knew who he was long before. So he kind of just stepped into this role. And I remember the first time when I saw you appear on Thomas Roberts on MSNBC, you appeared with Thomas Roberts, and it was only for a few minutes, and I was like so excited. I'm like, a trans woman on MSNBC, finally. For me, that was like so exciting because, I mean, I do this little internet radio show trying to make my little dent, and then finally it's like one of us is on the television, thank God. You know?
Well, I think it was kind of like a crescendo moment based on so many decades of work from women like you who've already been out there and actively talking about these issues and continuing to blog about them. And I think that it was just the access that I kind of had, right? Having worked in media, that it made it a little easier. And I think that also the uniqueness of my story, I guess, was a little different because no one knew who I was, and I was kind of just living my life after transitioning, and so I wasn't really sharing my transition publicly and visibly with the world. I was already the person, you know, I wanted to be, right? Like, I was just living and operating in the world, and then all of a sudden, it was kind of like I wanted to share, you know, my teenage years with the world and my journey to womanhood and all of these things, and so it was kind of like, I think, a sense of it was I was able to go beyond talking about transition because transition was such a long part of my life a while ago. By that time when I shared my story in 2011, I had quote-unquote transitioned about 15 years before. So I think that I had a different perspective and people kind of treated me a slightly different, whereas I didn't have to talk about transition so much and I could talk about issues more. And I think that's why I had access to being on MSNBC and talking with Thomas Roberts in 2012 and then having become, I guess, a quote-unquote Nerdland regular with Melissa Harris-Perry this year, which has been amazing. That's like a dream come true because I just love her so much. I've loved her for years, so.
I think she's terrific, and she gets, you know, major kudos from me for not only for having you on, but also we should point out to people that she's not only had you on to talk trans issues a couple of times, and you were great doing that, but she's had you on to talk about stuff just as a person, as a regular, to talk about Scandal, about the TV show, you know, that you just happen to be a trans person talking about television, as opposed to a trans person always constantly talking about being trans, which I think was a really big deal, don't you?
Oh, I do. I definitely do. And the fact that she also invited, like, other trans people were on the show before I was, and I wasn't the first, and that's also great, too. But I do think that there is a kind of a milestone and a marker, in a sense, that I was able to go on television and talk about pop culture. You know, I wasn't talking about my identity as a trans woman, specifically one of color or transition or trans rights. I was just on there, given a seat at the table to laugh and drink wine at noon on Sunday and just kind of gab about a television show and be accepted as another woman who had something to say.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Now, I got to ask you, you are the perfect person to ask this question because you have seen it firsthand. In fact, you've pretty much lived it firsthand. Have we finally reached the point where it's our turn, where we are becoming a visible part of the diversity that America is? Have we finally reached that tipping point, do you think?
Oh, it's so hard for me to say. I think that people are ready to hear about a plethora of issues, and I think that trans people tend to be one of the more, as you know, ever since Christine Jorgensen got off that plane in New York City, we've been something, a kind of spectacle that people have been so attracted to hearing about. But I think finally now they're kind of past it, past just hearing about, like, oh, someone went from a boy to a woman, or a man to a woman, or, you know, a girl to a man, or all these things, right? They're done with the transition part, and I think that they're ready to hear about, okay, so what is it like to live in, and what is it like to live in the body of your choice and still have to deal with all these different systemic oppressions and all these different barriers and all these different hurdles? And so I think that we're ready for that, but I still want to say that even though it may be our quote-unquote time, that there are still... I think there are a lot of people who are still very uneducated on the 101 trans stuff that I think that we may get tired as media people talking about, but I think we need to look in comment sections of stories about trans people and actually read what people are saying in those things, and most people are very uneducated. And so I think a part of this is going to be, we still need to educate people on what transgender, what transsexual is.
Sure.
And so I think that it's we still haven't had that huge media moment where people are like, oh my God, we need to talk about this. And I think the biggest one that we've had recently would probably say would be was Jenna Telekova last year. I think that was a big moment, but I don't think that the issues were elevated enough to make it talk more beyond her wanting to compete in a pageant. And I think that that was kind of a missed opportunity there.
I agree. Although, when we've got Donald Trump on our side, you got to think that some kind of milestone has been crossed there, I think.
But, of course.
I'm sorry?
No, go ahead.
Oh, no, one thing I wanted to ask you was, it's not just about being visible in the media, but also visibly trans. I mean, now you are very out and open, as is Chaz Bono. But one thing that you both have in common, along with Laverne Cox, who's now in a new show and is raising her profile, is that if folks were to walk past you or Chaz or Laverne on the street, they wouldn't know unless you told them. You've got a look that's very, I hate to use this word, but I'll use it anyway for the sake of the show, passable. And, I once made a comment on this show, and we were talking about Jenna Telekova, and we were talking about you, and I said, geez, Janet could easily compete in a beauty contest herself. And do you think that, A, that's a factor that's helped you ease into that role, and has it gotten in the way of other trans folks from doing that previously, do you think?
I think that when we talk about media, we cannot not talk about how people look on television. I think that that is a huge factor into how people see if you're valuable or not, right? You know, and when we talk about a visual medium, we have to talk about the fact of how people look. And I think that... Sure. I think even within our own community, I think there tends to be divide between who's trans enough, right? Yeah. It's like, and I think that we need to kind of unlearn many things about what the trans look is, you know, and I think that we need to kind of abolish those things, and we need to figure out, kind of delete these hierarchies in a way. For me, I know that the reason why I've had access to a lot of these things because I always point out not only my experiences of oppression, but also of privilege, meaning that I'm English-speaking, I'm educated, I have had access to work in mainstream corporate America, and also the fact that I am, quote-unquote, physically or whatever, desirable to a certain amount of people. And so I'd never try to, like, not talk about, quote-unquote, passing, and it has enabled me to, as a very young person, to be able to survive this world without... without going, you know, unchecked as quote-unquote trans or whatnot, and people calling me out, which dealing with all that violence and stuff attached to that as a trans woman of color, and living in people of color communities. So, sure, definitely something. But on the flip side, I think that it's also even specifically within queer and trans spaces, I'm also not seen as serious or as knowledgeable, you know, and there's also the flip side of quote-unquote beauty, you know. There's the fact that people see you as femme, you're femme-presenting, you love femininity, you wear a tight dress and lipstick and all these things, and you're not seen as serious, you know, or have something to really say. And so I think I've combated it on both sides, but, you know, I'm not apologetic about the way that I look, and I don't try to defend it, you know. And I know that it's a huge factor. It's a huge factor in media, you know, and it's a visual medium. And so, yeah, I don't know about the barriers for other people. I've seen tons of diverse people on television with diverse looks, with different looks, who've been on talk shows and have been on MSNBC as well before me. And so,
well, yeah, but you see, that's kind of like what I have perceived. Like, there's people like you and Chaz Bono, who doesn't really do a lot of talk shows. He seems like he goes on things like Dancing with the Stars and stuff like that. And there was Jenna Talikova, who's really a beauty contestant. She hasn't really made a big statement in the media. And then there's folks like me and like Mara Kiesling and, you know, folks who, you know, you just, you know, you see a picture of me, you know, and I'm not fooling anyone, and nor am I trying. But, you know, at the same time, it's kind of like, you know, if you have the look, and of course, television is television. There's a reason why I do radio, and I'm not looking to get into television. As a friend of mine who works in the business said, I have a face for radio. But, you know, I think there has to be it opens doors that you are as attractive as you are. Laverne Cox is as attractive as she is. That opens those doors, that puts you in a position to help make it more diverse in a way that people like, oh, I mean, Mara gets the call because she's the expert. She's the executive director of a major trans organization. I get the call. I'm going to be on HuffPost Live tomorrow because, you know, I'm Enda Radio Girl. You know, I'm the one who talks about radio. I'm about Enda. You know, so I get the call because of that. But yet, you know, you'll get the call to go talk about Scandal. Do you see what I'm saying? And Laverne will appear in a show, even though she's appearing as a trans character, she's on a major television show, and it's just, she's, you know, nobody is thinking of her as the trans actress necessarily, except for us, of course, because it's a big deal for the community. But she's just the actress who's playing that role, and I think that
I think Laverne is definitely seen as a trans actress. I think that I don't think that we've had any trans actress in Hollywood who's been able to, I think, get to the level of where she's at. I think Candace Cain has, and there's a few others that came before her, many entertainers. You know, we come from a long line of entertainers, trans women. And so I think that definitely, I don't think we've reached the level of saturation yet in media and pop culture curves to, like, say that she's seen beyond being a trans actress. I think that she's definitely seen as a trans actress. I think she's seen as a talented trans actress and activist, which I think is a big part of it. And what makes her so much more interesting is that she can be more than just a pretty face. She can be someone who has something to say. And then also, the next layer of it is, when has trans women of color, period, have had access that we have had now to finally be able to speak about our issues ourselves without other trans people who have had access for many decades to talk about these issues.
Well, let me ask you about that. Actually, I wasn't even sure I was going to go here, but what the heck? Do you think that there is, and it's hard for me to perceive. I mean, I'm white. I grew up in suburbs. My upbringing was, you know, the town that I grew up in at the time I grew up in, it was as pure white as driven snow. I mean, literally, we had one African-American kid in my high school when I went there. Now it's much, much more diverse. But in those days, I mean, that was just my upbringing. Do you think that there is a real set? Because I've heard this. I've heard accusations say that there's real racism in the trans community, that there's this attitude that white trans women are somehow considered better or more capable or blah, blah, blah. You know, the usual things that you hear. I mean, do you perceive that? And do you think, or is the overriding factor that we're all trans, does that overshadow that, do you think?
I would like to unpack it for sure. It's a lot, right? We live in a society that is racist, sexist, misogynistic, that is classist and elitist. That is not, you know, the trans community is not immune to those same ills, because we all live in the same American society that's built on racism, right? We think about stolen land, we think about stolen people, we think about stolen resources. That's embedded within the system that helped this country operate and thrive and be the way that it is, and to have haves and have nots. I think that trans women of color specifically have not had the access, the minimal access that me and, you know, say Laverne and Isis King and a few others who are out there and vocal have had to talk about our issues on our own without other people who have had access for a very long time to talk about our issues for us. You know, and so I think that that's the most powerful thing. I will not say that the LGBT community and that the trans community as well are immune to these same ills that plague our society, because they plague our society in so many ways, from grand oppression, right? Like the fact that trans women of color tend to transition young. And so doing that, you don't have many resources to get an education, to go to college, to get a job, all of these, so many hurdles and barriers. And then to more mundane things, like when we go into a store, can we get a cab? Can we get courteous service? You know, all of these things that, because of the color of our skin, even if we quote-unquote pass, we're still operating in the world as women of color, which is a whole other thing. And so I think it's a lot to talk about, you know, in the quick time that we do have. But I think that it's something that if we don't start talking about it as a community in a real dialogue, respectful, you know, acknowledging, really wanting to mirror and hear each other's experiences without anyone getting defensive and afraid and trying to say that I don't have that, that's not my experience, I'm not racist, so it should be fine. Well, it doesn't mean that just because you're not racist, you don't do racist things, doesn't mean that we don't operate in a world that does.
True. I mean, you know, we all talk about unconscious privilege and things like that. I think that would definitely play in. But, you know, it's interesting because as you said all those things that you were talking about, I thought to myself, I said, you know, I have experienced almost all of those things myself, even as a white trans woman, because I am trans. The not getting the cab, the getting the funny looks, not having the access. All those things have happened to me, granted, not because I'm a person of color, but because I am a trans woman, and specifically a trans woman who doesn't pass 100%. You know, you hear this voice coming out of, you know, this face, and, you know, it's not hard to tell after a while. You know, when I started doing this show, I mean, I can talk up here, but after a while I said to myself, you know, I'm going to be myself on the air, because if I'm not myself, what am I doing this for? And so I've worked that out for myself, but yet I'm also aware of what it has cost me to do that. And so I think there's a lot of intersection that we can come to as trans women, not only in terms of race, you know, but even if you put the race off to the side, which maybe may or may not be possible, but that there's a lot of stuff that we go through as trans women, period, that I think there's a lot of intersection there that I think is untapped.
Well, I think if the community was more knowledgeable in the intersections, right? I always say trans women of color, and I say and or low income, because low income white trans women also deal with a lot of oppression as well. And so it's not for the fact of saying that, oh, equating transness to race is the way to go. And I think that I've seen that a lot in dialogue. There's a lot of people talking about equating race to transness. And it's as if, like, we can't do that. Because for some of us, we can't erase those parts of ourselves. We operate in this world with all of those identities within us. And so, and it's also not to say do the oppression Olympics thing, right? We hear that all the time, the hierarchies of who gets to do this, who gets to do that, and who has more access and da-da-da. I think it's just something that we need to just continue to talk about. And I think that it going to go obviously beyond this conversation. But I think that all of us being out there and talking about these issues, and it's uncomfortable stuff to talk about. It's not the most glamorous thing. But I think we need to see that there are, you know, there are a lot of divides. And, that, you know, I speak around the country about these issues, and a lot of the spaces I speak in, I'm the only person of color, you know, yeah. And that's, you know, these are queer spaces. These are women's studies spaces. And, you know, that's something that, you know, why aren't trans women of color in these spaces? Why aren't queer people of color or LGBT people of color in these spaces? And we have to discuss those things, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, another thing I wanted to ask you, and this kind of plays off of what we've been talking about, was I saw The Outlist, which you were in. It was an HBO special. Had basically, it was LGBT people in these short vignettes. And I thought it was extremely well done. But one of the things that I saw in your segment was, you know, it was one of the things that we always see when we see a trans person. One of the first things we saw was the boy pic. The boy picture. And I was wondering, it brought up to me, because I thought you were terrific and the way you were presented and presented yourself was awesome. But yet I say, well, you know, here we go again. It's the same, you know, where you're defining yourself as a woman by who you were decades ago. And I was wondering, you know, there's one argument which I like to tend to side with, which says, you know, that I don't want necessarily anybody thinking of me as anyone other than a woman. And when you see a picture like that, it reminds people that didn't start out that way. And I'm wondering if you think that's a good thing. Is that, where do you come down on that?
I think that definitely immediately, that's a problem. You know, thinking that it's a prerequisite to telling a good story, that you need to show before pictures, quote unquote before pictures, or you need to show, hear about what their quote unquote given name was. I think that in the context of this storytelling project, I had more of an issue with the fact that there weren't other trans people in it, or another trans person's experience within the piece, than I was about the fact that they used childhood photos, because every single person in the piece had childhood photos. I wasn't the only one targeted for childhood photos. The only difference is that I'm trans, and the fact that my childhood photos is of a little boy. And, you know, that's just the fact of it. And that's not something I'm ashamed of. If I was in this project and everyone else did not have childhood photos, or that, you know, I was the only one with childhood photos, then I would have had a huge issue with it. But because everyone else had it, I thought it was a part of the storytelling project to talk about, you know, you grew up this way. How did you learn identity? How did you learn what being LGBT was and all of these things? And so I was fine with it on that level. I was more irritated by the fact that there weren't other trans people within the portrait beyond, you know, drag performer Lady Bunny.
Gotcha. Well, we only got a few minutes left, so I got a couple more things I really wanted to ask you about. One of the things I wanted to ask you about was Girls Like Us. It seemed like it went from being a hashtag on Twitter to, like, some sort of movement. I don't know exactly. What is it exactly? And describe it. I mean, I'm not really sure because, you know, it seems like it just kind of appeared. I don't know.
I think that it's just a space. It's just a virtual space that we can all be in on different platforms. It started on Twitter as a hashtag. It was just something that I just came up with. It wasn't really a plan. I hashtagged an article and petition, and then I continued to do it, and then people started catching on and doing it themselves, and then it went beyond me. And now it's on Instagram, and it's on Tumblr, and it's on Twitter, and Facebook now, that Facebook's doing hashtag aggregation. And so I think that it's just another space that trans women can unapologetically occupy and to call our own and to share resources and conversations. And it hits the whole gamut of what trans womanhood is. And I like that it's beyond me. It's something that I kind of ignited and started. I always say that I'm the girl behind Girls Like Us or the woman behind Girls Like Us. And I like that it's just kind of there living, you know, out in the ether, especially now that social media gives us such power to have our own shows like you and to have our own spaces and to have our own conversations. And I'm excited about that. We can broadcast our lives in that space.
Cool. I love the way you put that, because, you know, it's so hard to, define, because it just seemed like it just appeared one day. I remember, you know, right after I found you on Twitter, I think it was just after I saw you on Thomas Roberts was when I, you know, sought you out. Because, you know, I see a cool trans person, you know, me radio girl has to go, you know, and go check this out, you know. And it seemed like it happened kind of organically that, you know, trans women just
said,
like that.
Yeah, I think there were a few trans women who were just very happy to have a space that was about positivity and was a space about not tearing each other down, but a space where we're kind of sharing stories and experiences and creating blogs. And there are other radio shows that started out of it and other, you know, there's other platforms now. You know, I think there's like Gender Queers Like Us and Guys Like Us. I don't really use those because those aren't my identities, but I'm happy that people, it's igniting people to create spaces that maybe weren't there before. And so it's just one of many spaces. I'm like, please create other spaces so we can have more spaces to be in.
Absolutely. Now, the last question, I know we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you, I know you're writing a book. And, you know, as we said earlier at the top, you've been a writer for a long time. You wrote for Marie Claire. You told your story. Well, what can you tell us about that project?
Oh, the project. Wow. Yeah, it'll be out. My memoir will be out next February 2014. It's basically about my path and my journey to womanhood, to authenticity, to my mission as, you know, being someone that talks about intersectional gender and social justice. And it's about just kind of, it's like an extension of that piece that I did in Marie Claire, where it's about kind of telling my story about not only transition, but what happens after that. What happens when you live in that body and then you choose to like shed that anonymity and speak out about things and be a very vocal advocate and woman. And that's kind of what the book is about. It's just kind of my life story so far.
Cool. Because, you know, I was thinking to myself when I heard you were writing a book and it was autobiographical, I say, God, she's so young. It's almost like, you know, it seems like it's too early for you to write the autobiography. You haven't, I don't know. I mean, is this like maybe a first part, you think? You think you'll write another down the road?
I don't think that age is a big factor of it. I think that I have a very unique experience because I had transitioned as a teenager, as a child, basically. And so I have a lot of space from that experience, and I think I can offer a lot of insights about how it means to navigate gender-segregated spaces in school. And then also, what does it mean to be someone that, quote-unquote, passes in this world and the issues that come up with that within the trans community and also just within, you know, the heteronormative, cisnormative community. And I think that a lot of it's personal experiences, but most of it is about contextualizing and elevating those experiences in a political lens.
That's awesome. Janet, I want to thank you so much for taking the time and coming to talk to us. And I hope you'll come back because this was terrific. I had such a great time.
Well, thank you so much for creating this platform, for doing it, and for inviting me to be a part of it. I appreciate it.
Oh, I love it. I love you. I know our whole community loves you. And I hope you'll come back and talk with us again, especially when your book comes out. And, you know, because, you know, we see you in the media and it's important for us to get to know you, not just the person we see on television or read an article, but also, you know, get to know you as a person, which is part of what's exciting for me is I get to help you do that. So at least a little bit.
Well, anyway. Thank you so much. Thank you.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
Have a good one. Bye.
All right. Good night. All right. Oh, wasn't she awesome? I love her. I love Janet Mock. I think she is so awesome. I really do. I think she is like my favorite trans, I don't know, celebrity? I don't know if she qualifies, but she does to me. Let's put it that way. Anyway, we are going to go to a break. And then after the break, we will be back with Will Kohler from Back to Stonewall. So stick around for that. We're going to be talking about the religious exemption in ENDA. It's going to be good, gang. Stay tuned.
My name is Mia Macy, and I was originally born in Phoenix, Arizona. And one of my first memories, probably 3 or 4 years old, I knew that I was supposed to be a little girl. So I remember every birthday, just that was what I asked for. And I didn't live in an environment that was really socially acceptable. So I went the other way. I was going to be Superboy. I was going to do everything to just suppress that feeling. And so playing sports or hanging out with guys. And then when I turned 18, I thought, then I'd go in the military. I got out of the military and I went back and started school and testing to be a police officer. And then worked my way up as a detective. And then went into public affairs, and then eventually to the computer forensics, where we investigated robbery, homicides, and child sex crimes. Within 72 hours, I was notified that the position was no longer available. And like everyone in the world, I was watching the federal budget fail. It looked like government was going to shut down. They had sent me, she said that she had lost all the positions. She wasn't going to be able to fill any of them. Sorry about that, but you lost your job. So I thought that's the reason I had lost it. But then like everyone, I watched Washington live in D.C. and at like 9 p.m. at the last minute, the budget went through. So I was all excited. And then, so the next following Monday, I called her and said, okay, I'm ready to start. And she wouldn't answer my calls. They wouldn't answer my phone calls. They wouldn't answer my emails. They wouldn't answer anything. So I went into panic mode, started looking for work, started looking for a job. Went to the Transgender Law Center, though, because different employers that were interviewing me were like, you should talk to somebody about this. So I went to TLC, and we just started an initial inquiry. And what we found was that they did, in fact, didn't kill the positions. They actually kept the positions, but they hired somebody that was unqualified. They had never been in the military, never been police, never been trained. And subsequently, they also came to me and said, you might have a legitimate complaint. But unfortunately, because you're transgender, it's not covered as a complaint. And that was, like, devastating. Because I was like, wait a second. I could have a legitimate complaint, but I'm not an equal citizen. Serve my country, serve my community, but I'm not even allowed to go to court or ask the questions that I wanted to ask. I will be so happy that Macy V. Holder is just like a footnote in a book, and INDA or something comes in and trumps it. And it's going to take reports like this. It's going to take the work of all these groups getting this on a national level. We need a universal process that just encompasses us, protects us, and lets us live and be productive people in this society. We're not there yet, but I hope it's in my lifetime.
Let's get out of here. Look, Emerald City is closer and prettier than ever.
You won.
For sticking around, and as we were talking at the top of the show, we were talking about the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, and one of the things about the Employment Non-Discrimination Act that doesn't get a lot of discussion in the media is the religious exemption, which is pretty broad, and it's pretty controversial as well. There are a lot of people lining up on both sides of this issue, and one of the people who has a very strong opinion, along with myself, is Will Kohler from Back to Stonewall, the blog, the history blog, and he's on with us. Hey, Will, how you doing?
Hey, Rebecca, how are you?
I am good. And I wanted to, but let's start with the basics. As most of us know, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, it's making its way through the Senate. Looks like it could have a good shot to get through the Senate. Not so sure about the House. We've got so far 17 states that protect all their LGBT citizens from workplace discrimination. An additional 5 protect gays and lesbians. But the exemption in this bill, it's 3 parts. 2 parts of it are not that big a deal. It's kind of what you would expect. There's an exemption for churches, houses of worship, and religious schools and things like that. There's also a codification that ministers and people who work for religious organizations involve teaching or spreading religious governance or religious supervision are protected from, in other words, they can, are not protected by ENDA. They can be fired for not being of that religion, which for most people would make sense. The part that's really controversial, though, is this extension, which basically makes it okay for any religiously affiliated corporation, even if they're doing non-religious work, such as a Catholic hospital or something along those lines, to basically use the same kind of religious tenets and to hire and fire based on whether they're gay or trans and refuse people work. In other words, ENDA would not apply to, for example, a Catholic hospital that had a gay nurse or a transgender janitor or something like that. And that's really where the controversy is, don't you think?
Well, there's really more controversy than that.
Okay, well, straighten me out.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't really have a great connection with you. I hope you can hear me and I hope I can hear you.
Everything's fine.
I can hear you fine.
Oh, great. Well, you know, and this pains me. This really pains me. I've been a backer of ENDA for such a long time. And just the way this has gone down is just mind-boggling to me. Let's start off basically with the religious exemption of ENDA, which is based on the religious exemption in Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Now, the 1964 Civil Rights Act does not give religion the right to discriminate against a subset of people. All it basically does is it gives the right for religious organizations to hire preferenced on the person's religious faith. So, which is a choice. It doesn't say that it cannot discriminate against women. It does not say it can discriminate against blacks. It's a matter of faith. Now, there are many LGBT people of faith around. I mean, there are many LGBT Catholics, there are many LGBT Jews, Muslims, Hindus, but to actually make it okay for them to discriminate on who someone is instead of what their belief is just insane, and it's basically writing discrimination into law if it passes.
Okay. Well, I see what you're saying. Do you feel that as an activist community, as the LGBT activist community, are we caving on this just to get the bill passed, do you think?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I really don't even have to think this because I have heard at Netroots Nation, overheard, and actually was in discussions with people who were involved, and their biggest line was, it's better to get something passed than nothing at all.
Well, we can say that the person who said that, because I was in the room when that was said, it was a person we've had on the show a couple of times, Freedom to Work's Tico Almeida, said that basically that he was fine. He helped write that exemption, and he's fine with it because he said exactly what you said, that it's better to get something passed than nothing at all. And there's an argument to be made that you say, well, you get even the flood bill passed, and then you can go back and fix it later, as is frequently the case with other legislation.
But no, I actually don't. In this case, there is no way that they will be able to go back and say, okay, we're going to take the religious exemption out and get it passed. See, this has always been a problem with our gay organizations. They don't know how to, you know, play poker. They went in there giving away the entire farm, as it is, to start out with. You know, they can't, you know, and already the Republicans still aren't happy with it. Alexander says he has three amendments that he wants to try to add to it. And from what we've been hearing, it's like, you know, gay public school teachers, LGBT public school teachers, you know, public schools being exempt, things like that. So they're just not happy, and they will never be happy. But we went in there, and, like, we gave it the farm. And, you know, it's just a really horrible thing because the ACLU has been saying for months that they were going to try to get the religious exemptions, you know, like, narrowed. Now, all of a sudden, they disappeared from the issue. I've called Ian Thompson from the ACLU, who's in charge of it. He has never gotten back to me. They didn't say a word yesterday about it, except to say that they're pleased it passed. And, you know, they don't really think the religious exemptions are needed. But they didn't say that, they didn't go that one step further, saying that we're going to fight it. It's just become such a very, very horrible thing that we're ready to, you know, legitimize what the right wing says to get this passed. I mean, if we, like, do this, we're basically saying that they're right about all those things that they say about us. You know, I mean, and that is not right. I mean,
I know what you're saying, but also there's another argument that I've heard, and I'm sure you've heard it as well, which is they say, well, you know, we know that, and chances are almost 99.9% chance, unless barring a miracle of some sort that we're totally not expecting, this is never getting through the House, that it's not even getting a vote in the House. So it's not going to become law this session anyway. So the argument that I've been hearing from certain quarters is, why not get the thing passed in the Senate the way it is, and then by the time we're ready to come back in the next session of Congress, we can then go and negotiate and fix it, and presumably in a better position where, you know, hopefully Democrats have the control, and then there would be a better chance of changing or rewriting whatever and fixing that. Do you have an issue with that?
Well, a lot of it has to do with a matter of integrity. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we do that now, you know, then, and, you know, like, we're doing it because, you know, we just want to pass Senate and, you know, we sort of know it's not going to pass the House, then why not do it right anyway? I mean, it's not going to go into law. I mean, but this way you're just playing with people and you're playing with religion. And, you know, you're setting a horrible precedent. Say it passes the Senate, but it doesn't go through the House. Say other LGBT legislation comes up a little later, before ENDA. And then they go back to, and then the Republicans go back to, well, you were willing to put the religious exemption in, like, the ENDA that we were going to go with. Why don't we put it in here, too?
Yeah, yeah, I can see what you're saying, but also,
you know, I mean, you did say that there's, like, a really low chance that it's actually going to get to the House and get passed through the House. But yesterday, Tikva Almeida also made a statement that whenever ENDA in the Senate does come up for a vote, and he named the months, and he went all the way to October. Now, if ENDA made it to the Senate floor in the end of October, it probably wouldn't be voted on until, you know, like mid-November, early November, after the midterm elections. So if by any chance the Democrats did take over the House, there is a slim chance that this actually could pass.
Well, hang on a second, though, because we're talking about October of this year. This year is 2013. The next year's elections aren't for another year and so and few months. So,
oh, we'll
theoretically, yeah, it, you know, it wouldn't, yeah, actually become an issue until after 2014. I mean, until when the next session is actually sitting, which would be the beginning of 2015.
Oh, all right, this is true, and that was a mistake of mine, but. You know,
I just wanted to point that out because, you know,
yeah,
I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute, that doesn't sound right.
It's late in Ohio. The sidewalk go up here at 6. It's way past my bedtime. But,
it's okay. But here's another thing that I heard yesterday. When they passed out of the committee, one thing that I heard that kind of, I guess, I mean, like I said, it doesn't really change my overall opinion. I've said this earlier, I agree with you that I think that the religious exemption is too broad, at least too big a hole for people who want to discriminate, that they could just literally turn around and say, God told me to hate you, so I'm firing you because, you know, you're an evil sinner, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so I'm on your side there. I mean,
but
at the same time, I also saw Orrin Hatch, Utah Senator Orrin Hatch, a staunch conservative, say, yes, I voted for this bill, and the reason I voted for this bill is because it had this strong religious exemption. If we would lose votes in the Senate by changing that now, doesn't it make sense to leave it alone until we're actually at a point where this thing could actually become law?
It does, if we could actually trust those in charge to take it out, which you know, is a crapshoot. You know, sure. I mean, Harkin said that he didn't want to take it out because he was afraid he'd lose to Republicans. If he said that now, it probably goes to suit that he'll, that will happen later on also.
But, right, you know, but of course, we're also, don't forget, we're talking about a situation where we don't know what the makeup of Congress is going to be in 2015 because several senators are going to be up for re-election just as several as the representatives, all the representatives will be.
Well, this is true, but, you know, also we don't know where all the Democrats stand on this. You know, well, we had to shame Democrats into standing up for DOMA for the Supreme Court.
True.
Now,
true.
I mean, we have blue dog Democrats that, you know, they probably will not want the exemption taken out also. So it's
yeah.
just very, like, bad territory. It really comes down to, at least to me, it's... You're just saying it's all right to discriminate against another person in the name of God.
I'm completely, you know, like I say, I'm completely on your side with that.
And it also will go into some federally funded programs because Bush signed executive orders in 2002 that allow certain religious organizations that receive federal funds to disregard the Title VII exemption in 64. And that's another thing. You know, it's so full of holes that, you know, I mean, I know they want to get it passed, but it just makes it seem to me that there just really hasn't been a lot of forethought into the writing of this.
And that I agree with, totally. I think one of the problems, don't you think, though, Will, is that we don't really know how do you define a religiously held objection? You know, I mean, could you just turn around and say, God told me to fire you? Or does you have to be able to show, no, I'm not just making this up. I am a religious person. I go to church every year. I have my business as religious people, you know, that you actually have to show that there's a there, you know, that you can't just hide behind, just do whatever you want and claim God told me. You know, I mean, that's what I has not been made clear to me is exactly how does the qualification to discriminate on a religious basis work when we're talking about not just a Catholic hospital, but, you know, some, you know, Joe's Sub Shop who's owned by Joe who happens to be a Catholic. You know,
well,
I mean,
that's another ironic thing in the Title VII exemption is that it's not just for organized religions. It could be anyone who says they're a religion and gets paperwork for it. You know, you could say you're the Church of Joe. If you get the right paperwork and you get yourself called a religious organization, then you'll be free to discriminate. It's amazing. And, you know, people need to remember, too, that the Title VII exemptions were written over 50 years ago. I mean, the world's changed. People have changed. And, you know, I mean, I wish we would change. I wish our organizations would change and actually man up and grow some cojones and, like, stand up and say, hey, we're not going to do this. We're going to take a stand. And this is the way it's going to be. But the whole thing to just pass something out of nothing. I mean, we're going to give an exemption to the people who abuse it the most. I mean, that's just ridiculous. I live in the Midwest. The last 5 cases of LGBT discrimination here have been through Catholic schools.
Yeah.
One of which, a straight man was fired for the fact that, well, for the fact that he supported gay marriage. He wasn't even gay. He was fired for the fact that he supported straight marriage. And this institution will get a pass on ENDA so they can keep doing stuff like that.
Yeah, that's exactly where my questions come in, where it's like, you know, where do we draw the line? I mean, if a church says, we don't want you here because we believe you're sinful, we don't want you worshiping among us, I have no issue with that. I think that any church and every priest has the right to marry who they choose. A church has the right to welcome whichever parishioners they choose. That is their business. And I certainly don't have a right to insert myself into that. But when you're talking about a non-religious employer like a hospital or another type of organization that is not really where the religion is not in the forefront, that's where I have the question. Is it seems like I think the line needs to be defined much, much clearer and say, yes, you can define who you want to be a priest. You can define who you want to sit in your pews at Sunday, but you don't have the right to determine who's going to sweep your floors at your hospital. I think isn't that where we have to be able to draw the line? Because I do think that there should be a religious exemption for genuinely religious belief and that kind of thing. That if a church doesn't want a gay Sunday school teacher, that should be their right. I think that is not unreasonable.
Well, do you agree? No, I don't think that's unreasonable either. I do think what we're dealing with now is unreasonable. The one thing, I mean, I've always been pushing for ENDA, mostly because there's never been another alternative. But you were at the caucus at Netroots Nation when I was going over the history. And in 1974, when Bella Abzug actually tried to amend the 1964 Civil Rights Act to add LGBT people as a protected class. Now, you know, a part of me wonders what would have happened if we would have, like, worked on that for the past, like, 40 years instead of ENDA. You know, I mean, it blows the entire religious argument that we want special rights out of the water, because it's just saying we want the same rights as everyone else.
Right. I agree with you there. I totally agree with you.
I think it was such a misstep. And, you know, again, ENDA only happened in the 80s when they thought it would be easier to pass than getting the Civil Rights Act amended. In this day and age, it would probably be easier to get the Civil Rights Act amended than ENDA.
Yeah. I tend to agree. Listen, before I let you go, because we're almost out of time, another thing I wanted to ask you is something you wrote about on Back to Stonewall. We've been seeing there's a new sci-fi movie that's coming out in November called Ender's Game, which is based on a novel by a novelist named Orson Scott Card, who is a raging homophobe. He is a Mormon who has basically called for destruction of the United States government for supporting gay marriage. I mean, this is almost like Westboro Baptist Church level stuff. And now there's a boycott effort starting up. And I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit, what your take on this is.
All right. Oy vey. Scott Card. Also, a non-board member. National Organization.
Yes, or National Organization of Marriage.
I mean, yeah, and you're right. He's been a raging homophobe for years, called for the overthrow of the government, called homosexuals, you know, like pedophiles, called for us to be put in jail. Dude even rewrote Hamlet once to, like, make Hamlet's father a pedophile, which is why Hamlet kills him. All right, yeah. This guy is a piece of freaking work. Now, Ender's Game is a novel that he wrote in the, you know, years ago. And the ironic thing is, it's about a story about a boy who questions attacking an alien species they don't understand. You know, the irony is just not lost on me. Oh. So, you know, it's finally come out. You know, people are beginning to, like, see this, that, you know, like, Summit Entertainment, which is releasing the movie, is actually hiding Card at Comic-Con. He's not been invited because they are afraid that, you know, something might start up. Now, I caught that story on the Hollywood Reporter, and I reported it. And so it began to snowball. Geeks Out, which is a organization of LGBT geeks like me, picked up on it, and they are calling for a boycott. And, you know, a movie boycott, you know, may not be really effective, but it has gotten so much press at this point psychologically it's been effective. I mean, people know about Card's raging homophobia now. I mean, it's really split, like, the fanboy community. Many people are saying they don't want to see it. You know, a lot of people are like, well, you know, it's his freedom of speech. What they don't understand is that the money he was paid for his story went to back his hate speech. Also, he's got a producer credit on this movie, which means he's probably going to get a share of the box office.
Yeah, I should also point out that this is not the first time that this sort of thing has happened. There's actually a video game called Firefall that I originally started playing. It's a new game. And I got involved with it. I even invested a little bit of money in it. And then I discovered that he wrote the backstory for it. And I didn't know this. I wasn't aware of that before. Once I realized that, I was like, all of a sudden, I felt obligated not to play it. Just like when I was a kid, I used to listen to Ted Nugent, and I used to actually went to see him play live. And now that I know he's like this ridiculous raging right winger, I can't listen to his music anymore because that just overshadows his creative work for me.
Oh,
and,
really, Motor City Moron Ted.
But the thing with
Card is that. No, the company involved, the movie company involved, any of the stars of the movie, the production company, Warner Brothers, I think it is, you know, they haven't said a word. They've kept quiet on this for the entire thing. But, you know, luckily people's consciences are, like, going to rule this. You know, personally, I wouldn't go. You know, I don't think any gay person going would be, like, paying money, would be like a Jew paying money to see a Lenny like Riefenstahl film during World War II. You know, it's just ridiculous.
I think we're going to see. It's going to be interesting to see, but as it gets closer and as this gets more coverage, I think it's going to be interesting to see just how much support there is and how it translates at the box office. I really think that is going to be something interesting to see, and it may even be a gauge of just how far we've come socially and politically in this country as LGBT people.
Well, I find it interesting that GLAAD has not said a word about it yet.
Yeah, I tend to agree. But then again,
and
you know,
GLAAD,
this is
I'm calling you out on the air.
Yeah, I tend to agree. And you know what? At some point between now and then, I'm going to try and get somebody from GLAAD on the air. Maybe we'll question them about that. Hey, listen, Will, we are pretty much out of time. We're actually a couple minutes over. So I want to say thanks for calling in and talking with us. And I hope you'll come back again because you cover so much good stuff on Back to Stonewall that there's always something good to talk about.
Oh, I love you, dearie. Thanks a lot for having me. And you have a glorious evening.
I love you, too. And we'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. All right. And that, of course, was Will Kohler from Back to Stonewall. And always, I love him. He's terrific. We were hanging out at Netroots Nation and also in Philadelphia at the convening when I went to that. He's a good guy, and I'm sure we're going to have him back on again because he's literally a font of history, of queer history. So always a good guy to have on. Anyway, I think we are about due for a break, and we have a lovely musical interlude with talking about a revolution. Justin Julian Bond. And we'll catch you in 5, gang.
Talk about a revolution.
It's me, Flash. It's been a river hellhole. You know where you stand in a hellhole. Folks lend a hand in a hellhole. Girl, get me back to my hellhole.
Becky, you and I have been talking about the Arizona fires, and it has been a hellhole here in northern Arizona, just a few miles away from that terrible wildfire. Those brave firemen and the memorial service, and you called it right. Fred Phelps and Westboro Baptist Church did not show up to protest, thank goodness, but they sent the B team. So we got Westboro Light instead. Some weird
goodness.
Offshoot. They actually have a copycat group, which is maybe affiliated with WBC, maybe not. But they ended up in jail, and there was a lot of cheering. The Hell's Angels came. I mean, this was quite a little zoo here this past week. And really a sad situation with the firefighters. They call them hot shots. And hot shots are highly trained firefighters who go in super physical fit training and stuff like that. And what a terrible shame, all of that happening.
It really is. And you know, I mean, I think a lot of times people don't realize, you know, because we take it, we kind of take it for granted, especially in areas like my own area where we're not very prone to these kind of disasters. Although, you know, when we never had these kind of, you know, problems, and then Sandy hit, and boy, did we gain an appreciation for our first responders. I will tell you.
They're amazing.
Okay. They really, truly are. I mean, these folks, when we had Sandy, just like with you guys, I mean, granted, we didn't have the incredible tragedy of 19 firemen. I mean, that was just beyond... you know, I can't even imagine what that must be like. But we had, I mean, you know, you drive down the road, you see a cop sitting on the side of the road, you just kind of take for granted that they're always going to be there. They're always looking out. You know, most of the time you see a cop, the first thing you think of is, oh, I better slow down so I don't get caught for speeding.
Yes.
You know, I mean, really. And then, you know, I'll tell you, right after Sandy, we had, I mean, our town was half... I won't say half destroyed, but the road system in our town was half out of commission. I mean, trees down all over the place. And in order to get from, like, one side of town to the other, you literally had to go in this huge circle. And these cops, I swear, I didn't even know we had that many cops in our town. They were out there. They were directing people. They were helping people. They were everywhere. The emergency services. I mean, these guys are... unbelievable. And we should never forget that. We really, really should never take these people for granted. And I think there's a tendency that we do. And we shouldn't. We should remember that these guys, when things are at their worst, that's when they are at their best.
And we've actually had the likes of John McCain saying sensible things about, the sequestration, getting rid of that immediately. Imagine him saying that in this context and putting those dollars into managing the forests better and making sure that the dollars are going to firefighting efforts. This is a really tough fire season in Arizona and certainly all over the West. And we're not nearly anyway through this mess yet. There could be more problems, but we're crossing our fingers here.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I think we should always take a moment, you know, to think about those people and people who literally often enough. End up making the ultimate sacrifice. Even if they don't, they were putting their lives on the line. And I think we should remember and honor that. And I don't think we do enough. I mean, sometimes we do when we're faced with a big disaster, a tragedy like 9/11 or the fires and things like that. You know, we suddenly remember. But I think we need to also remember when it's not a tragedy, to remember what these people do and what kind of security they provide for all of us. And I think it's important that we we're conscious of that.
And really, they were remembered super nicely. I thought, what a nice memorial service on TV. Some of the cable channels had it. Gosh, we had 14 satellite trucks here beaming that all over the country. Joe Biden was here, did a really nice part of that memorial. We had Jan Brewer. All right, Jan.
We saw it all over here. I mean, I saw more... you know, and of course, Mom and I are sitting there, we're watching television, and, you know, we're all looking, it's like, hey, you know, you see Mike out there? No, I don't think so.
He's all over by the satellite trucks, geeking out on the equipment.
They call it a hunch, but I don't think we're going to catch him.
I didn't expect to see you out there.
But, you know, just seeing that, your little neck of the woods got got more coverage in the last, I mean, for obviously not great reasons, but it was like, oh, my goodness.
Well, in a small town, we found that we had a lot of connections to this. I had met that fire crew about 4 years ago. They were doing stuff for the city. This is the only city-operated fire crew, hotshot crew of its kind in the world. And the city had them doing... kind of a danger remediation program where they would go out. We have a problem with our ponderosa pines here. They get infested with a beetle that kills them, and they get to be extremely hazardous for fire unless they're removed. So these guys came, about half of that crew came to my mother's house about 4 years ago and removed 11 40 or 50 foot ponderosa pines. What an amazing bunch of guys to watch those guys work. And I feel a little bit on the loss, you know?
Absolutely.
Many of us do.
All right. Well, you know, we had some amazing, amazing interviews tonight. You know, Janet Mock, she's just as amazing. She was just as terrific on this show as she's been on Melissa Harris Perry. And you know, she gives me hope. She gives me hope that you know, we have somebody who's so good at it. She's so skilled and she's so, I don't know what the word I'm looking for, competent when it comes to being a trans person on the air and presenting us in a positive way and in a, you know, that I, you know, normally my first instinct as a trans woman who doesn't pass so great is to say, oh, she's so pretty. Does she really represent us? And you know what? It doesn't matter because she's so good at it and she's so conscious of her own privilege and she's so tuned in that I am totally comfortable. I don't know that I would be with somebody who was, you know, if it was, let's say, Jenna Talikova, you know, who I think is lovely and very pretty, but she's a pretty girl without, you know, and she may have a lot to her that we haven't seen. But I haven't seen it. Do you know what I mean? Whereas Janet, there's some real depth there. There's some real, I mean, this is a smart, intelligent, thinking together woman. And I think that serves us so well in the media. You know, there aren't a lot of us who can do that. And you know, I mean, I'm sure I would I love to go and do MSNBC? Sure I would. Okay, but you know what the truth is I'm not very pretty. I mean, I was better looking when, you know, 16 years ago when I came out, I wasn't terrible looking. You know, I never looked as good as Janet, even on my best day, you know. But it's a reality, as we were talking about earlier. It's a reality of television. You know, again, I do radio. I love radio. I do radio because I love it. Let's be honest. This is what I do. This is what I love doing. If somebody turned around to me someday and said, hey, would you like to do a TV show? I probably would try it. You know, why not? But this is my passion. This is what I do. And so, you know, the fact that we can have somebody who can go into an MSNBC, who can go into the mainstream media and present. And you know, and then we also have, you know, the Mara Kieslings who can go. And I mean, Mara is great because she's not only recognizable, visible as a trans woman in a way that I think Janet is, like, she's so put together, pretty, let's be honest, pretty, that I think sometimes you forget. I mean, you literally forget because she pulls it off so well that you forget that she has a history there. Whereas with Mara, or with somebody like myself, or with other trans women who aren't quite that hot, quite frankly. I mean, she's a stunning woman. Okay. It's different. It's different because there's always that trans thing is always right in your face. And you know what? I think you need both. I think you need both. You need the Janet Mocks, but you also need the Mara Kiesens. You also need, well, you know, without sounding like I'm all full of myself, you need people like me, you know, who I may not sound ultra feminine, I may not look ultra feminine, but that doesn't change my identity. It doesn't change who I am. It doesn't change my transness. It doesn't change. Do you know what I mean? So I think you need both. I think you need to see the side. You know, and let's not also forget that I think that there's a lot of trans men. Trans men don't get the same level of coverage because, you know, it's almost like I believe that this is probably culturally a factor, is that it's always been more socially acceptable for a quote, and I'm putting it in air quotes here, you know what I mean, quote, a woman to want to be a man. Than for a man to want to be a woman, if you know what I mean. Because a woman, someone who's born female, let's put it that way, and aspires or just chooses to live their life as a man in the social and construct, the male gender, if you will, that's seen by culturally as a step up. Because we live in a patriarchal society and men are seen as the ruling class in a lot of ways. Men control most of the money, most of the business. And so for a born female to want to be a man, that's seen as a step up. Whereas a male-born person who aspires to be female, who wants to be a woman, who is a woman inside, well, that's seen as a step down. And I think, and I'll tell you something else, and I've talked about this with friends, and I get a lot of support on this, where I think men in particular have a problem with trans women because men, as a rule, and this is, I think, and as true of gay men as it is of straight men, a lot of men are... A lot of their pride and self-identity and self-worth is wrapped up in that thing between their legs. You know, that their manhood, their sense of masculinity is not centered around it, but it includes that as a key component, is the penis thing. And the fact that trans women say, yeah, I was born with it, I don't want it. I don't identify with it. I don't see it as a part of me. It doesn't define me. I reject it. I was born to it, and I reject it. And that, I think, is very threatening to a certain type of man. And I think that is a part of a cause of the violence. I mean, let's be honest, okay? Trans men tend to pass through life much better than trans women. Part of that is visual. A lot of it is visual. These guys grow beards. They shave their heads. They grow hair on their bodies. Nobody gives them a second look. So that's a big part of it, too. Their voices deepen. I mean, you know, for example, you listen to somebody like Ethan St. Pierre, and you hear that voice that he has, you would never in a million years think that this guy was once a woman. And he, I mean, I suppose you could make the argument he never really was a woman. He was just living in a female body. I mean, we all know that rhetoric. And let's just, come on, we all know that. I'm just considering that a given because I know who I'm talking to here. Okay. But that's the thing is you just don't perceive that. Whereas with a lot of trans women, it's right on our faces 24/7. Even some of those of us who look good, you know, you can still see it. You can still hear it. And it's something that we have to live with as women throughout our lives, and it doesn't get better. I mean, you know, we have to work around it. And the problem, and I think that's where we wind up conflicting with society. You know, I mean, that's where this whole bathroom bullshit comes in. You know, I mean, you never hear anybody complaining, oh, you know, a woman might walk into a man's bathroom. You never hear anybody complain about that. Oh, and hey, guess what? We have a caller. And I think I know who this is. Is this Dion?
In living color.
Hey, how you doing? It's good to hear one piece. From you.
So far, so good. I called for a couple of things. I couldn't let a good chance to mention that penis is overrated to be said on the radio. The second and third reason is that while your subjects were great, the way you handled the interviews were great today as usual, and it's not far removed to say that we need someone like you to help put the truth out there so people can see it.
Well, I appreciate that. And you know, as long as I got you on, Dion, you're great at talking about this stuff. I'm sure you were listening when I was talking to Janet about race and about how that plays into the trans community. And I was wondering if you had some thoughts like that, because you, of course, are an African American trans woman. And
no.
I was wondering if you had some thoughts about how race plays into the interaction between trans people and trans women and the rest of the world.
We're a visual culture as we're a visual species. The way we communicate with each other, 8 to 10 seconds, we figure out what it is that we need to communicate safely or to act in our own personal best interest. And the first two things that are observed by human beings are race and gender. And
sure.
The fact of the matter is that it's not bad. It's not good. As the saying goes, I believe it is what it is. You cannot take race out of the picture, just like you can't take gender out of the picture. And one of the things that I've come to find out through my transition and other sorts of things, at the end of the day, when the makeup's off, when you're in by yourself, you are who you are. You know, I know that scientifically speaking that the gender is on a continuum, but we tend to box things so that we can manage our worlds better. And I am in the woman box. Some people may not like me in that box, but there you go.
Well, there's always going to be. I mean, that's one thing I think we all know. And this is something I was kind of touching on with Janet, was that, you know, there's certain things that you know, I, as a white person who grew up in a white suburban community, will never be able to relate to from the perspective of an African-American. But yet there is a lot of intersection between what I have experienced and what other trans women, regardless of color or where they come from, there's a lot of intersection where we meet in the middle on that. And I think that there's so much opportunity to intersect and to work together on those kind of issues. Don't you think?
Well, I'll put it out like this. Martin King said it best. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. The reason that you see that, why you feel that there is overlap, is because stuff like that is just plain out and out wrong. Whether it's done on the basis of race, whether it's done on the basis of class, whether it's done on the basis of intellectual or sociological experience, whatever oppression is, or people prejudging people, or as opposed to taking the time to get to know them, it may not always be, may not always feel safe to do that. But I think the thing is that I listened to you a long time before I called in, or even before I let my feelings be known. I, you know, I didn't want to prejudice myself, the fact that your experience is different than my own. But I think that there are points where there are points, as we have in the past, we've agreed, there are points where we disagree. But the fact that we can agree on, and I think that you, our mutual friend, Ethan St. Pierre, and a few other people like Janet and Laverne and a few others who too many to mention in the time that we have left. Yeah. It's that we're all bloody human beings. And as such, we demand and should be able to expect from our fellow human beings the same equal treatment under the law and under the heavens.
Yeah, I tend to agree. And yet, at the same time, I agree with you about the human being thing, and I think that's where we need to certainly, you know, work as we reach out to the rest of the community and integrate ourselves into, for lack of a better term, the straight community, and even into the gay and lesbian community for a lot of us. I also think that we need to reach out, and I think we tend to do this when we tend to box a little bit, and we tend to say, you know, these folks, whether it's a physical place or whether it's race or whether it's ethnicity or any other of the little boxes, we wind up, you know, segregating ourselves, I think, a little too much. And I think we should look less for ways to segregate and more ways to say, let's combine. Let's take, we're a small community, relatively speaking. We should be going out of our way to look for ways to unite and work together rather than segregate ourselves into even smaller boxes, don't you think?
Well, I am all for working together, but at the same token, I think that you can't, there are certain things that are about us that are uniquely us and made us us, in queer space, in racial and ethnic space, and even in class space. Well, while we might be a quote-unquote mixing pot, as someone who likes to cook in the kitchen, I like the idea of balance in my recipes. It makes for better tasting and better impressions of the meals that I prepare. But
sure,
you cannot. I think the overall thing too is that not every spice is the same, and you can't have too much of one spice or ingredient in a recipe without it having a direct effect on the others. But each item in a recipe in and of itself has its own flavor, its own texture, and its own tone to make the end dish something that you want to eat.
Right, and it's how you mix it up that makes the difference, right? There you go.
It's not just how you mix it up. It's also that they're able to keep their own identity. If you put garlic in everything and you made garlic everything, then in your seasoning, you would eventually, if you didn't have garlic, you would miss it. But if somebody used less garlic in a recipe, it wouldn't taste the same to you, and you would lose your appreciation for it.
Absolutely. absolutely. But yeah, and so, you know, I think there's plenty of places where, yeah, you know, absolutely, people need to keep their own identities, but we also need to be able to blend those identities when it's politically and socially and humanly advantageous for us to do so.
Agreed. There are places where we can do that. I think there should be more of them. But at the same token, I fully encourage. I think that's one of the reasons that our educational system has lost its edge and its appeal, because people are finding that there's no the way that things are being taught now, there is no place for them in it.
I hear you. Hey, Dion, guess what? We're out of time. Thanks for calling in. I want to say thank you to everybody. Thank you to Janet Mock. Thank you to Will Kohler. Thank you to Dion Stallworth. I can guarantee you we're going to be hearing more of that lady very soon. And thank you to you for tuning in, for supporting this media. We will catch you next week. Our guest will be Mara Kiesling. We'll catch you then. Have a good night, everybody.